Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to Wandsworth Station at the Nene Valley Railway. We're here today, we're celebrating 125 years of the Railway magazine, and we're very lucky to have the current team as well as three previous editors here. So we have Pete Kelly, Nick Pygott, Chris Milner, myself, Paul Bickerdike, and Gareth Evans, the deputy editor. Now, Pete, when did you take over as editor?
I took over in 1989 until 1994. And I'm starting to feel a bit old now, because I must be the oldest surviving ex-editor of Railway magazine.
But you kind of brought the magazine out of the dark ages, if you like, into more of a news-driven...
My predecessor was John Slater, and he'd been there for quite a few years. He had a brilliant engineering brain, and he had a big grasp of railway history. But the magazine was mostly a kind of chronicle of railway history and fairly deep articles. Mm. And the way the market was going at the time was with more of an emphasis on news. And of course, colour photography was coming in. I mean, once upon a time, it was rare if you got two colour pages in a magazine, you thought you were lucky. And it was a wonderful time to be there. And John, he was retiring at the age of 60, but he carried on because I was working from home in Peterborough. Mm. And he would go into the office every day. He lived at Putney in London. And he would keep his eye on what was coming in. And I always, of course, picked him to do the book reviews, because if anybody knew about history, he did. And I think John was still working for us when I left.
He was indeed, yes.
Well, John's still volunteering there when I started in 2004. Yeah. Yes.
Well, every weekend he'd leave London, maybe on a Thursday night or a Friday, and he'd take the train to the Tallitlin Railway, and he had a little terraced house there, and he would spend all weekend in his overalls, you know, making rivets and whatever.
It was fish plates.
That's right. And then he'd come back on a Monday morning, happy as Larry, because he'd had a good weekend. And I had a lot of respect for John. He might have come from a slightly different age, but I was always glad that he was there. You know?
I think with John, I think one of the most incredible things was his knowledge.
It was.
And his recall of things. And he was very quick to put you right if he thought something was factually incorrect.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we had many a lunchtime drink in a pub at Sutton in Surrey, John and myself, and I liked his company, you know. Mm. I was sorry when I heard that he passed away.
Yeah.
He was a real character, wasn't he?
He was.
The old school. I think the problem was, from a commercial point of view, that he'd been there slightly too long, and he'd allowed competitor magazines to overtake news-led ones. Mm. And he wasn't a journalist, as you know, Pete, so he was starting to flounder a little bit, and I think the magazine was reflecting that. The circulation was going down, wasn't it? And you came along with your news hat on and your experience in journalism, and you turned it into a news-led magazine. Yeah. You got new contributors in, and you stopped the rot.
Yeah.
And I was able to benefit from the foundations that you'd created and take it on to sort of greater.
Well, you did. You took it on to wonderful things, and we used to meet together quite often anyway, didn't
we? That's
right.
We still drink lunchtime drink, didn't we? At Stanford.
But I was fortunate because I'd come from a different publishing firm, as you know, and I'd been editing railway magazines before, starting in 1980.
Yeah.
So I already knew a lot of the people who were likely to be. Correspondents, yeah. Bill Sharman and people like that, you know. That made it a lot easier.
Yes. You know. Yes, absolutely.
And then Chris joined us in 1990, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, October 1990, yes.
He was a very good photographer. Mm-hmm. Used to send all kinds of things in. Mm-hmm. And once a month we'd meet up somewhere and pass the package across.
Yeah.
And I was very happy there. We had an excellent crew. And I was working from home. Mm. And in those days, the height of technology was a fax machine.
Yeah.
And I'd take my wife out for a Chinese meal in Peterborough and I'd come back all relaxed and happy at about, 9:30 at night. And we'd open the front door and the hall would be full of papers from Colin Marston's modern tracking stuff.
All folded up on top of each other, wasn't it? It was the same at my house.
It was all good stuff.
Yeah. But it was also an era, Pete, that if you recall, the only computer that we had in the office when I joined was one that Brenda Brownjohn, the secretary, used to send letters to readers.
Yeah.
Everything else was done on a typewriter, wasn't it? And we used to send off the subcopy on a motorbike courier that went all the way to Maidstone in Kent.
Yeah.
It was typeset.
Yeah.
We used to have it come back, change it and do all sorts of things. And it was so primitive, and it was still probably 3 or 4 years before we actually moved on to what were then sort of embryo desktop publishing packages.
Yeah, it's primitive now, Chris, but state of the art at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, we not that long before that we'd been on hot metal.
Yeah.
Well, the only way, when I was working on a different kind of title, we'd have a Sunday night press night in London, and we spent half of the night going to all the London stations waiting for parcels to turn up with prints in them.
Yeah.
You know, there's no email stuff.
I know.
We had people in the office all day long, copy typists.
Yeah.
And people would ring up and it was very, very complex. I don't know how we did it, but we did.
No,
and I mean, the daily newspapers were run on the same lines.
Oh, they were. I mean, I was in
goodness knows
the time,
how they managed.
It was all hot metal. Yeah. Right up to the late 80s. Yeah. But UK, when we had our centenary in 1997, UK Press Gazette, bless its soul, came and did an interview with me.
Yes.
And when I read it, they'd printed something I'd forgotten I'd said, which was that we were dispatching everything, photographs, prints, slides, the lot, little old-fashioned floppy disks and everything. It's all going in a big package on the back of a motorbike.
That's right.
And we had to send it out to the designer who lived in Essex, rural Essex, and then it all had to come back again and then get sent out again on a van to the printer, you see. And I'd said something, this is bloody ridiculous, So in winter, all these icy roads and dikes, dikes and the fens and everything. Yeah. And I said, I absolutely dread this motorbike skidding and the whole bloody lot going into this dike, you see. Yeah.
Always a possibility.
And it was a nightmare, wasn't it? Yeah. And they put that in.
There was another period where our printers were in Bournemouth.
That's right, yes.
And I was working from home. And we were doing, I think it was a 24-page supplement on the railway photography of Eric Tracy. So
Bishop of
I'd been captioning all these photographs at home and everything, and it was getting closer and closer to press day.
Yeah.
And I finished at about, 7 o'clock in the evening, and I thought, I'd better get these over to the printers now.
Yeah.
So I got in my car, drove all the way to Bournemouth from Peterborough.
Yeah, yeah.
I got there midnight time, knocked on the door, and this disgruntled bloke opened the door, and I looked in, and they were all asleep on the floor in their sleeping pads. So then I thought, so I set off home again, stopped for a sandwich and a cup of coffee somewhere, And I got home at about, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And I thought, right, I might as well start work again now.
Yeah, that's how it used to be. I mean, because we were always late, we always just slightly missed the deadlines, you know. And we didn't have, we had sort of couriers, but you had to ring up and order them.
Yeah.
So, like Pete, you know, I used to drive the whole bloody lot, because it was all turned into film at Peterborough, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then you had to get the film to the printer. Well, the printers were either Colchester or Bournemouth, or in my case, Milton Keynes. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? If I start ordering printers this time of night, they're going to say, why were you so late? So the only thing to do was jump in your own car and drive it to the printers yourself and deliver it. Of course, it's, you get there, it's all locked up, you know, and you think, oh, God, dare I leave it outside the door? You know, I don't know, what if it gets stolen? Yeah. And there's all this. And so then you got back home, having done it, middle of the night, didn't you? And then the next morning, you think, I wonder if I want to charge that to expenses, you know, the mileage. And then you thought, no, I daren't, because I'll know what I've been doing.
In terms of putting the magazine together back then, was so say for instance you get a feature article, and that was all somebody would type that out on paper. How would you start to process that?
You'd sub it. And you'd send it to the printers,
and then they'd
and they would just copy what you'd done.
Yeah.
And in the days of hot metal, you had these rows of linotype machines. Mm. And about 20 blokes rattling away on them.
Literally rattling.
And you got used to reading proofs upside down, back to front, of course, because that's the way hot metal was.
That's right.
I remember when I joined, we had these layout sheets, didn't we? And we'd get the galley proofs back. We used to have to cut them up, work out the picture sizes, and obviously scale them on the back, and then stick the galley proofs on.
Yeah.
It was a real sort of Blue Peter type job, wasn't it?
You were literally cutting and pasting.
It was all cutting and pasting,
And then those sheets used to go off to a repro house, and then we'd get the laid out thing back, wouldn't we?
You get a wet proof back, but you'd also get what's called a chromoline.
That's right.
And this is all your pages. Every page came out in this big, very thick, glossy thing. And that was
like
the only way you could
print.
Yeah, but it's the only way you could tell that the colour was going to be as you wanted.
Yeah, that was it.
So we used to get a great batch of these, didn't we, every month.
Yeah. But it used to look nice at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The layout's
yeah.
looking neat and
yeah.
tidy. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And now everything's done on screen.
Yeah. So who started working on computers then and not computers?
It was our era, Pete, wasn't it? Because
when we were at IPC, King's Reach Tower.
Yes.
Yeah. We were about 18 stories up or something,
yes.
wasn't it?
Yeah. Nice views.
But
yes.
they said it's time we taught all our staff to use computers, and we had to take these computer courses with someone showing us the basics of how to operate them. And you know, it's like we were saying about John, you get stuck in the mud over the years, don't you?
Oh yeah, definitely.
And when something new comes along, you say,
you can't handle it.
What's all this about? What was wrong with the way we always used to do it?
Yeah.
But my God, how would we manage to do it?
Oh, God. John was the last person in the whole of Kingsbridge Town that had a typewriter.
Yeah.
So which year would that have been then, Pete?
About 1991, something like that.
It was the early 90s. Yeah. I mean, what we were given, what the company provided on our desks, because obviously laptops weren't even invented at that stage.
No.
We had this very slim Apple Mac.
Right.
That took a 3.25-inch floppy disk in the front, and it was mono screen.
Right.
You would just type in the words as if you're doing a letter or something like that, and it was that's how it was, wasn't it? I mean, we didn't really have email, I don't think, in those days.
Oh no, that came in 1995.
That came a lot later.
Because it was CC mail to start with, wasn't it?
Yes,
I remember when Brenda first got it,
and
she only used it for letters.
Yeah. I mean, you probably remember that when John was getting used to the computer, because obviously he came from a different technological
age. He never did, Chris.
He used to come up with this big bubble on the screen saying, I think you're trying to type a letter. And he used to say, no, I'm damn well not. You know, he used to get quite indignant about the sort of self-help hints that used to come out from the software.
I've got to say this, none of us would have managed without Brenda Brown-Jones, who was a wonderful secretary.
Absolutely,
she
and she's more or less run the job.
Oh, yeah, she was the girl Friday, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Was Brenda already on the magazine when you started?
I think she was.
Yeah, I think.
But she was always there. Yeah. You know, if you had a problem.
Yeah, got us organised.
Yeah. Oh, she did.
And she stayed until, what, 2011 when...
When the magazine was sold by IPC in 2010,
mm-hmm.
I think that's when, yeah. obviously, the people that were based in London didn't move with the title. Right, yeah.
One thing I loved about the Railway magazine, of course, was that it was about modern traction and steam. Everything was in it.
Yeah.
And I got very friendly with the Scottish director of Railway Affairs, Bert Gemmell. Did you know Bert?
I knew the name, but I didn't know the matter.
Well, I got very friendly with him. There was one occasion where they were going to name a Class 47 the Queen Mother in Aberdeen. She must have been at Balmoral or something at the time. Anyway, Bert said, are you coming? I said, yeah, all right. He said, well, why don't you bring your wife along? I'll send you a first-class sleeper ticket to get there. We'll put you up in the big hotel at Aberdeen Station, and then we'll give you your train fare to... your train ticket to go back the next day. And it was lovely. He was always coming up with ideas. Have you ever been along the Kyle of Loch Alsh line? No, Bert. Oh, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you come along on such and such a date, and I'll see if we can add the director's saloon on the back of it, just so that we can have coffee and what do you call those little Scottish biscuits things that you have?
Shortbread.
Oat things. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But so there we are in the grand, and you've got the sleeper up to Inverness, have a look at the Kyle line.
I've got to say, as enthusiasts, we were in the perfect job, weren't we? Because the number of perks you get, and the number of free trips abroad, and to railways you could only have dreamt about, you know. Yeah. And we were lucky because we were able to catch the end of the steam era on a lot of these lines, weren't we? You couldn't do it now.
Yeah.
So, you know, in terms of being paid to pursue your hobby, it's the best possible job, isn't it, the railway man? Because as you say, steam and modern traction, and international.
Yeah.
And I've always been grateful to Pete, because, and indirectly, because... You left and handed it over to me just in time for the centenary.
Yeah, I know.
And the millennium.
I know.
And the Queen's Silver Jubilee. I was so sort of lucky that I caught it there, because you could so easily have stayed on.
I think you organised a wonderful leaving present of one of the Peterborough station signs.
We did.
Didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
We did, and I've still got a picture of the presentation, but I couldn't find it last night, so I'm sorry, Bill. But that's good. That's good.
Wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen some very interesting historic things in our tenure, haven't we?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, when was it? Early 90s, you did that cycle ride for the A1 Tornado, didn't you?
Yeah, I was going to come on to that, because I cycled all the way from, which direction? I can't remember, but it doesn't matter. I made a little cardboard headboard to go on the handlebars, and it said "The Flying Scotsman." It was only this big. It was on the bike for the whole distance. It was very similar. It was a little white one, just like that. And on the way, we called at the Sidings near York.
Oh, York, Benbrook.
And I'd started doing a series on the railway paintings of Terence Cuneo, railway paintings of and it was a nice thing to do.
It was.
And we started doing the same thing with the railway photography of some of the famous photographers.
Yeah.
And I arranged for one of these painters to do an oil painting for us to present to the Sidings of the Silver Jubilee going past. And I think it's still on the wall in there. It was a lovely period.
Yes. Yes, it was. And I've just mentioned the souvenir issue. I mean, this is it. This is...
It's lovely looking.
I think, Paul, you asked me to say what was my favourite issue.
I think
this is it.
Yeah. And it's 1997.
Yes, July 97. And it's not merely my favourite because it's a souvenir.
Yeah.
And it's perfect bound. Yeah, I think it's the first perfect bound one we've done since we went big in '63. Yeah. And it's the features inside. I commissioned one on not just the history of the magazine, but the history of all railway magazines, all railway publishing, and a title for every taste. And I'm very proud of that because it's, as far as I know, the only attempt's ever been made.
It's never been done before.
And it's got this full list, you see, of everything and the dates that they ran to and who published them and everything. It goes right back to 1830s because there was an original railway magazine before this one.
Right.
And not a lot of people know that. So that's probably the article I'm proudest of.
Yes. I mean, we always try our hardest, don't we? But some come out somehow better than others, don't they? Or ones that
Yes. It's not the interview. The interview that I'm most proud of is the one with Alan Pegler.
I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah. That ran to four issues.
Yeah.
I could have done the book
former,
on that.
Former owner of Flying Scotland,
yes,
of course.
Yes. He was the most fascinating person I ever interviewed.
But going back to the centenary, we had that lunch at York, the dinner at York, didn't we?
Oh, that's brilliant, wasn't it?
Yes, and we actually had the three former owners.
We did.
The current owner and two former owners of Flying Scotsman there.
We got Alan Pegler, Bill McAlpine and Tony Marchington together in one place, didn't we? It's the only time that photo was ever taken.
Yes.
And do you know, there was a bit of a panic the night before, earlier that day, because we'd all got to York except for Bill, and I got a call on my brick-sized mobile phone outside. And I'll never forget this. And it was Bill, and he said, "We're very heavily delayed." He said, "I'm in the back of a car at the moment." He said, "I'm somewhere near Ostend or somewhere." He said, "Is it really important that I get there?" And I said, "Well, it is rather, Bill." I said, "Well, I'm going to struggle to make it, and I've really got other things I could be doing." I said, "Bill, please, if you could just keep going, because we've got Alan and Tony already here."
Yeah.
And that's what swung it. Yeah. And he said, "All right, I'll do my best." And he turned up. So thank God for that.
Yeah, amazing. Did you have a favourite issue or article, Pete? The one that sticks in the memory?
Well, there's several stick in my memory, but the 1990 issue, I think it was the centenary of the Fourth Bridge. And they'd gone to all kinds of pains. They had floodlights on the bridge and fireworks and things. And we did the story of the Fourth Bridge. I think 70 people were killed building it, you know. And in the following issue, I started doing these centre spreads in colour. And we had a lovely colour of the Fourth Bridge, all lit up.
Orangey, wasn't it?
And that was one of the nicest centre spreads I remember.
That was my picture, Pete. If you recall, you sent me up there, and I was standing on the banks of the Forth.
Well, that was why it was so good, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I was with the fireworks, but I stood on the banks of the Forth, freezing my watsits off to get these, what were obviously historic pictures.
But it was memorable, wasn't it, Chris?
Yeah.
A few years later, Chris and I went up there. We were invited to actually go on top of the Forth. And we went up that rickety builder's lift, do you remember?
Yes.
That was literally open to the elements.
Yeah, but on the side
that
of
went
the...
straight up the side of one of the great big, you know, cantilevers. And then it got on top of the first cantilever, didn't it? And it was a big flat area, about the size of a football pitch. But there were no fences, do you remember? We had to try and venture as close as you dare to the edge to get pictures of trains coming underneath like that. And then said, "Oh, we've got to get to the other side of the river now, the Firth. So we all went downstairs. And there's me thinking we'd be walking along the track because we've got never more people with us, you know. And all of a sudden they said, "Now you've got to go through this trap door." And we went through this tiny trap door down a vertical staircase, and we were on this rickety little path that was open to the elements with a low fence either side and nothing but the raging water beneath you. And we had to walk the whole length of the bridge. You were okay because you don't suffer from vertigo. But
was it underneath the tracks?
It was slung underneath the tracks, and it was completely open to the elements. And I had to get from one side, and it's the most frightening experience I've ever had. I wasn't crawling, but I was literally pulling myself along like that at about 1 mile an hour.
Yes.
It was, well, I was awful.
Well, I'm fortunate to have been up a second time as well. So,
rather you than me. I'm proud of the fact that I did it.
Oh yeah,
but I was so scared.
Terence Cuneo did one of his paintings from up there.
He did,
didn't he?
Yes, he did.
And
and didn't they stop the traffic for him so he could get the train station?
Probably did. They would have done
get
that
his
kind of thing.
Yeah, I think they did.
And when I started this thing on railway artists, Terence was one of the first to rang up,
yeah.
And I rang him from my house in Peterborough about 9 o'clock in the morning and said, wondered if we could arrange a little meet-up, Terence, get the story of, you know, your life with Railway Art. And he said, oh, I'm going to Mexico tonight. The plane leaves at 8. I said, oh, well, we'll wait until you get back then. He said, what do you mean? You've got a station, haven't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, get down to Peterborough Station and I'll meet you at the station. That he'd lived near Epsom in Surrey somewhere.
Yes, I went there once.
And he'd lost his wife and everything by then. He was living on his own in a big Victorian kind of terraced house. Yeah. And it was fascinating to be sitting with that great man. And he's telling me this story in front of a raging fire. And I didn't need to ask questions. He wrote that article himself. He just told me, and that was what I wrote down. And he got back from Mexico, and then a few years later he fell into ill health.
Yes.
And he was in a nursing home somewhere.
Yes.
And I went to see him, and he'd done one of his special edition prints for somebody, and they just arrived when I got there. And I was pushing this great man to get his meal with these old ladies that were in the same home. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm pushing Terence Cuneo in this wheelchair, you know.
Yeah.
And then he didn't last much longer. He died after that.
So I went to see him for another magazine. But when I got to the Railway Mag, I decided to do the same thing with David Shepherd.
Oh,
I don't know if you've ever been to his studio, but he lives in this beautiful, well, he lived, he's dead now, isn't he? But he passed this wonderful sort of stately home he lives in.
Yeah.
And he's got a studio in a separate building about as far away as those Nissan huts over there. And we walked across his gardens to go to the studio, and I did the interview and the photographs there. And while we were there, he was painting a painting like this, and he's got all his wet oil and everything, and I was taking pictures. And when we came back out to go back to the house for a meal, it started raining. And he said, oh dear, raining. He said, I'll take the painting with me. And he said, come with me. We went down some stairs, and we were suddenly in a subterranean tunnel. And he built a tunnel under his garden to get back to his house so that his painting didn't get wet.
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately, all these railway artists, Barry J. Freeman, Don Brecken, David Weston, I'm not sure about David, but most of them have gone now.
They're all gone. Mm. Philip Hawkins is still around.
Yeah. He's around.
And Malcolm Root, of course. They're my two favourites, I think. No, it's a good series, Pete. It stood us in good stead for a long time, that, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, the photographic one, I thought, was just as good, because you've got these incredible archive pictures from people.
Yeah.
And you could do a lovely 5 or 6 page feature, just saying a little bit about the artist and, you know, doing the captions.
Yeah, you could do that. You could. There's several things, like you could turn into books or bookazines almost. Yeah. You know, like,
I think today we're swamped with images, aren't we, because of the digital age.
You're asking, Paul, what was the moment that we... Our earliest moments, you know, were concerning the Railway Mag. In my case... I became a spotter in the late 50s, but I was a little bit sort of insulated by strict parents from actually finding out what was going on in the outside world. So really it was a case of my house, my bedroom overlooked the East Coast Main Line, but it was too far away to actually see numbers and names. So I could just see what class it was, and that was about it. And then they started allowing me to go through the fields on my own. You see, I must have been about 9 or 10. I was standing close enough to the line, and the next train that came along was this northbound express, and it was hauled by an engine with a number and a name. And it was, I thought, oh my God, what's that? Miles Beaver, 60026, you see. And I thought, oh, that's right. And then I thought, well, I'll wait to see if the next train's got a number as well. And of course, it was some filthy WD come clanking back the other way. No, that was not got a number. I didn't find out until it had got a number. It was so filthy, you see. Yeah. So I was walking down, and the next train came along. Like, oh, that's got a number. So I got home and I told my mummy, and she said, oh, right, okay. So next time we went shopping, I went into this little bookshop with her in Grantham, and there was these ABC booklets. She said, "Mum, can you buy me one of these? It's 2 and 6. And it was the summer 1959 edition of the Eastern, Northeastern Scottish Region booklet, you see. So she bought me that. That's how I got hooked, you see, because I started underlining all these numbers, you see. But even then, she said, "Oh no, I don't want you going down the station on your own. You know, there's too many sort of town boys down there." So I was sort of unaware that there were other magazines. That there were magazines about, and it wasn't until I got to school. I went to boarding school, and it's a place in Rutland, and a classmate of mine called Dave Lee, and what had happened was, it was 63, right? So in 63. The format of the magazine changed from about this size to a larger size. Yeah. Still not A4, but about that size.
That's true.
And they had a colour picture on the front and everything. But they did a really stupid thing. They changed the size in the middle of a year. So it became November 63, was totally different size to October 63. Why they did that, I don't know. But anyway, it meant that for years afterwards, they had these funny bound volumes with two sizes of magazines in them. Anyway, because they wanted to promote the fact that they'd changed the format and made it a much better looking magazine, they apparently, the publishers sent out free copies of the Jan 64 issue to a whole load of addresses on the database. And this Dave Lee's father was sent one. So after he'd read it, he gave it to his son. He said, "There you go, you might be interested in that." So his son brought it to school, and he was reading it in the classroom. And I said, "What have you got there, Dave?" He said, "Oh, it's this magazine my dad sent me." I thought, "Blimey, a magazine about railways, isn't it?" I said, "Can I read it?" He said, "Yeah." And then I thought, "Can I buy it off you?" And he went, "Not really." I said, "I'll give you all my pocket money." So we used to get a sixpenny piece pocket money. And we used to go down the tuck shop and spend this on foodies and sweets. Yeah. So you could get quite a few sweets for sixpence in those days. Yeah. And I gave him the whole sixpence, and he said, "All right, you can have it." And that's how it started. Wow. So that's the spark that fired the passion. It cost me money. Yeah. It's been costing me money ever since. But anyway, I took it home, and I showed it to my mum, and I said, "Can I have it on a regular basis?" She said, "Well, I'll buy you a subscription for your birthday."
Oh, wow.
And that's how it started.
Oh, how old had you been then?
Well, I think when I got the first subscription, I'd be 11.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking about the East Coast Main Line. I don't know how many people you know this, but Nick is famous for knowing off by heart all the names of the A3 Pacifics in order.
I was.
When it was your leaving to York,
oh God,
you remember it. Yeah. I put you on the spot, didn't I?
Don't do it again.
I won't, I'm not going to. But I started reading these numbers and names of the A3s, and then I said, "Go on then, Nick." And he stood up and reeled off about another 12 or 15. Incredible.
Oh, yeah. I think it's because your mind's at a formative age, isn't it? Information goes in and stays
there, doesn't it?
It wouldn't happen now. But yeah, no, they've been old friends, aren't they? I think all steam engines are old friends, aren't they?
Yeah.
You must have found that in your special.
Absolutely,
days,
yeah.
I think one of the earliest issues I remember was, probably in 1989, I was still at school then, but where we lived, we backed onto the Leeds to Bradford line, which was all diesel, and I was in a shop and I saw the issue of the Railway Mag, and it had a colour picture of the APT on the front, which was not on the electric, but it obviously was very futuristic at the time, wasn't it? And I just had to know more about it. As it happens, there wasn't much about the APT in that particular issue. But it had a great picture on the front.
Yeah.
But there were some great articles inside, not least there was a PMP about HSTs on the East Coast Main Line. And who would have known then that the HST would still be going for like 40 more years on the East Coast Main Line?
Yeah,
that was amazing, wasn't it? They lost it.
Yeah.
And they still look as modern as they did.
Well, yeah,
when they started off.
Yeah, they're amazing trains. Yeah. They saved BR, I think, didn't they? Yeah. And to think they were originally created as a stopgap.
Yes.
Just because the electric hadn't gone ahead at that time. Yeah. Ironic, really.
What was your first connection with the magazine, Chris?
Well, I first started reading it, I won't say on a regular basis, but probably, I think it was April 1966, and I think I remember the front cover was a blue AC Electric,
right,
which obviously later became a Class 86. And used to read it on and off then. And then I remember that when Steam finished, at the time I was living in Leicestershire, and the Great Central wasn't very far away from where my parents lived, and the Midland, Leicester Midland, was equally sort of a couple of bus rides away. And when Steam finished in 67, 68, I lost a lot of interest in railways at that time. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of dissipated. I think I was of the age where it was girls and football, right, which is probably the same for quite a few of us.
Yeah.
And it was only when I started to realise in the early 70s, when the Westerns were starting to go, it was like, because you couldn't travel far, I think because of limitations of where you could travel because of age, right, and the parental control, I started to get more interested in Westerns and things like that. And eventually, you know, I went off chasing and went to Reading and went here, went there. And, it, you know, the bug had bit me again. And I started to get a bit more into mainline steam. I was working with people who knew a bit more about mainline steam, right, and went off with a couple of guys. And it was Chase Flying Scotsman. Yeah. And it really evolved from there.
Mm. Were you taking pictures from the start?
Yes, unfortunately I don't have them, but I remember back in the day taking pictures at Barrow-on-Soar, of 8Fs, 9Fs peaks with brake tenders and stuff like that, you know, that used to regularly come through.
Yeah.
And obviously I remember the demise of the Great Central and how that sort of ended. I mean, as a youngster, we regularly used to go down to place in Leicestershire, just on the outskirts, called Aylston, and see the York to Bournemouth train, which was quite often hauled by a Great Western 460.
Yeah.
And eventually that got turned over to an English Electric Type 3.
Yes.
And, you know, it's sort of memories like that that sort of kept it rolling. And but, never in my wildest years did I ever think I'd actually be writing about railways and writing really what people are going to read in the future about the history at the time. It's been obviously an immense privilege to have been able to do so.
Yeah.
So despite being a child of the Midland region, you were interested in Western region.
I think it's like a lot of us, that when we realise
the Westerns are special,
something is going to disappear. I mean, it's like, as a comparison, we've just lost the Class 455s.
Yeah.
And I've had a couple of trips to London just to photograph them, because not living in the area, not travelling in the area regularly, you don't see them. So you think, just nice to get a few pictures before
you
go.
While you can.
Yeah. And it was the same in a way with the Class 303s in Scotland. I had a couple of trips to Glasgow to photograph them. And I think obviously now, because of the awareness, we tend to do that a bit more. So
I think the fact that we are the age we are has been quite helpful in editing this particular title, because I don't know about you, Chris, but when the diesels first started coming in, they were brand spanking new and hadn't got any dirt on them or anything. It was quite exciting. I actually found myself loving steam and hating it when they were all going, but being sort of strangely excited by the brand newness of these new engines. I remember looking into the depths of Peacecliff Tunnel once. It's all black, obviously. And suddenly, I thought I'd gone to heaven, because a white engine came out, pure white, and it was Lion.
Oh, right.
The prototype Lion, and it was white. I went, what?
Yeah.
You know, you never forget things like that, you know.
60 years old this year, I think, Lion.
Yes, yeah. It didn't last long, did it? It was a shame, because it was a good engine.
Yeah. Yeah, well, how about you, Gareth? How about your first memory of the railway?
Well, Dad had been reading it for many years, and, you know...
Did he have lots of copies lying around the house?
Yeah, he still has. He's got I've always said it's been an official library, to be fair. Lots of railway books, lots of railway magazines, and they've survived many attempted culls by the domestic authority. So Dad was always, as they read, in railway literature, so of course want to be like Dad, you know, and read the railway magazines, and so then you, by reading it, you pick up different classes, what they are, don't you, by reading the captions. I always think, as an editor, it's important that the captions are informative, because I remember as a reader how that helped to enrich my knowledge. And then you get inspired by different images, the writing styles. So, it's reading railway titles as a youngster help then me to, I used to think that I'd like to have a go at writing and taking photographs, and so that's what I started doing from the age of eight. But and then started to contribute then to the Railway Magazine, to Cliff Thomas for Narrow Gauge, and Peter Nicholson for Classic Traction. I remember meeting them at the Welsh Pool, and Cliff there. Cliff was always really nice with me, great gentleman, always encouraged me as a youngster, and now it's great to work and
with
have
them,
yeah.
That seems strange.
Same for Peter Nicholson. I remember meeting him at Woody Bay Station on the Linton and Barnstaple Railway, because we've been doing bits of volunteering there a couple of times when I was younger. Meeting Peter there, and gentleman.
Yeah. I mean, that just illustrates the great continuity we have on the magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this. You know, way back to 89 as editor and all the way through to us now.
Yeah.
And our contributors have been writing for the magazines for years and years as well.
Yeah.
One of the most rewarding things for me is what you just said, the fact that something I've written might have inspired someone of your age.
I think that
is a really nice feeling. Because at the time, you're just thinking, you're in the present moment. You're not thinking of what it might happen in 20, 30 years' time. Mm. You know, and... You know, it's a big shock to me the day to find out that the editor of Steam Railway wasn't born when I was first editor of the Railway Mag. You know, crikey, I didn't think I was that old.
The thing I used to turn to very often, which started in the Steam days, was locomotive practice and performance.
British locomotive practice.
British.
We had to keep shaving words off it, don't you?
Because they'd go on a train, wouldn't they? And they'd produce a complete timing log of the journey. If you got numbers like 90 miles an hour or 95 miles an hour, you'd be talking about
that's
it,
right.
wouldn't you?
Yeah. I used to just look down the speed column, because all the rest was
that was the only thing we were interested in, really. Yeah. But did you know Ozzy? Did you ever know Ozzy?
I interviewed Ozzy Pop. Yes.
Well done.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I would have loved to, but I never knew him. And by the time I took over, it was Peter Semmons that was doing it.
Yes, no, I did Ozzy. Mm. And also, I'm glad that I interviewed the person who at the time was Britain's oldest man. A chap called Vincent Gulliver, and he was 108, and he remembered his dad bringing home the first issue of Railway Mag. He remembers his dad bringing
issue one.
He remembers his dad bringing it home.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's something. Yeah.
That really sort of puts it all in context.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. We've had a brilliant
interview.
Are you alright, mate?
Yeah. No, I was just thinking of a question. How to ask a question for a moment. Yeah. Your first issue as editor.
Yeah.
Did that? Am I right in recalling that included a tribute to?
It did.
Yeah.
It did. And also Di Woodham.
Right.
Gosh.
Yeah. Both in the same issue.
Wow.
Yeah. I was thinking, God. Not my answer. No point in carrying on.
Barry Loco.
Yeah.
The Grim Reaper, please take a rest.
Well, yeah. But no, it got better. It got better.
Yeah.
You did 21 years, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you ever think you were going to do 20? Did you set out to do 20 or whatever?
To be honest, no, I didn't. Of course not. I mean, it wasn't until I got to level with John Slater, who did 19 years.
Mm.
When I got level with him, then I started getting interested in researching the history of the other editors to see how many issues they'd actually done.
Right.
And it was when I realised it was within reach that I thought, I won't resign just yet. I think the most, probably one of the most significant aspects of our jobs is having reported on the phenomenal changes that have taken place on the mainline railway network as a whole. And it's particularly appropriate now, with the Queen's Platinum Jubilee coming up this week, to look back on the fact that the Railway Magazine has covered not only her coronation, but her Silver Jubilee, Golden Jubilee, Diamond Jubilee, and now, believe it or not, her Platinum Jubilee. And 20 years ago, it's hard to believe she's still on the throne, because 20 years ago, I actually wrote in my comment in the 2002 July issue that there have been monumental changes on the railways during the reign of Queen Elizabeth II. when Her Majesty acceded to the throne on February the 6th, 1952, the then fledgling British Railways was building not only Britannias, but numerous Big Four designs as well. Not a single 9F had been constructed. There were only half a dozen mainline diesels. No one in the railway world had even heard of Beeching, let alone his axe. Freight yards the length and breadth of the country heaved with wooden-bodied wagons loaded with coal, cattle, fruit, and just about every other commodity imaginable. Winston Churchill was Prime Minister. The first motorway was still more than half a decade away, and only a few people had a car or television. Food was rationed. Millions of terraced house chimneys smoked from the coal produced by almost 1,000 collieries, and the workshops of cities like Manchester, Leeds and Glasgow were still steam locomotive builders to the world. It's hard to compare that with the present day scene and realise that it has all taken place within the reign of a single monarch. And Paul, that was 20 years ago.
20 years ago,
so
yeah.
What's happened since?
Well, I think one of the fascinating things about railways is when you look at it day to day, not much appears to be changing, but a little bit is changing all the time. And over the past two decades, it all adds up. So we've seen train operating companies come and go. We've seen pretty much the end of coal being transported by rail, which is a massive thing.
Massive thing.
But we've seen positive things as well. The Elizabeth Line has just opened, which is a huge construction project over the past decade or more.
Yeah. HS1.
HS1 from
HS1
Chris,
underway.
Yes.
HS1. Yeah. HS2 now. We're seeing. The intercity fleet's completely changed now, mostly based on Hitachi-type trains, aren't they?
We've seen at the end of a lot of the older rolling stock, haven't we? The Pacers have gone, the classical 5.5s have gone. There's a lot of other old...
Not much BR-era stock
left,
really.
No. Heritage Railways, they've changed completely, haven't they?
Yes.
Yeah, they've... the sort of happy-go-lucky days of volunteers walking across lines without high-vis vests and things, all part of history now.
Part of history, yes. Yeah. And yet, on the other hand, we're still seeing a great amount of mainline steam.
Yes. That's
great.
Big positive, isn't it? But the coal's going to be a problem for that soon, isn't it? I mean, where do we go with coal, environmentally wise and
sourcing-wise.
And sourcing-wise.
Cost.
Yeah. Cost-wise.
Yeah. It's a big struggle for many heritage lines.
It is, isn't it?
Cost of diesel.
Yeah.
It's easy to say just run a diesel instead, but you've got to fuel those as well.
Correct.
I think one of the things I find a little bit sad about recent developments is what you mentioned, the homogenisation of train design. There's so many of these IETs around now, you know, whether you call them Azulas or what. They're all the same front ends, with just a different colour.
Yes.
And it's, you know, they're on the Great Western, they're on the East Coast, they're on, you know, whole trains even.
Yeah, Trans-Pennine.
You know,
seem to be middle and mainline.
If every steam loco looked the same, it wouldn't have been the same.
Yeah, there's a bit of a reluctance to use the word boredom factor, but a lot of it's starting to look the same, as you say, just with different paintwork. The character of the railway that we knew and enjoyed all those years ago has also changed.
Yes. Yeah. Also, green tunnels have got an incredible, have had an incredible derogatory effect on enthusiasm. Because not only is it now almost impossible to see the countryside from the trains, so people tend to not look out of the windows so much anymore, but whereas I grew up overlooking a line, I could see what trains were running by my house. If I was living in that house today, apart from the fact a housing estate sprung up in between, so it's blocked it out anyway, even if that hadn't happened, the hedges have grown so high, you wouldn't even know there was a railway there. And that's the case all over the country. So any young kid trying to get into railways has got this big handicap.
The trees is another hot topic though, in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
People don't want them chopped down, but then again, from the safety angle, you've got the leaves falling in the autumn.
Permanent way is managed in a radically different way, whereas previously you'd have gangers responsible for their own sections of track, keeping a manual check on it. You've now got trains that will run and report, highlight defects and get teams out to attend to them. So you've got fewer resources spread over a larger area. And that's reflected in the line side attitude as well, isn't it? So keeping the hedgerows in check or whatever, you've got hotspots needed to be chopped to, say, a tree if it's blocking a sighting for a signal or a level crossing, but the rest of it's left to grow.
That's right.
And of course, another big change is signalling, particularly in the recent years where we've got the regional operating centres now taking over fast stretches of railway.
And you've lost
replacing even multiple power boxes, which were the state of the art in the past.
Yeah.
And that will change further as we move towards ETCS as well. So
we've lost that sort of personal touch where you could turn up on a stretch of line side and shout up to the signalman, anything due, mate?
Yeah.
And all that's gone now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you know you've got a sneaky CCTV staring at you from somewhere, probably.
Mm. But at the same time, as enthusiasts, we've got access to digital information that we wouldn't have had in the past.
Very so we've real-time trains.
And others that you can hear a train passing and you can look it up on your smartphone.
Yes, webcams. Yes, for every negative, there's probably a positive.
Yeah.
But it does take a lot of the element of challenge out of the hobby, I think.
Yeah. You know,
because it's a little bit like fishing in a way, isn't it? You don't know what's lurking beneath the water, do you?
No.
When you pull it out, it's a surprise.
Yeah.
And that used to be the case when you didn't know what was due next.
True.
Yeah. But now there's this temptation to look at your phone.
I suppose the element of surprise possibly is still there to a lesser degree, because you can be following a train on a website, but then if it gets terminated short because, I don't know, there's a breakdown or they haven't got a relief crew or whatever,
I mean, it must be even more pronounced for you, Pete, because you started spotting in the 50s, didn't you?
Yeah, and the other thing is that when I swapped from railways to different subjects, a lot of the modernisation went on that I didn't really know about, you know.
Yeah. Oh, you only have to turn your back for a couple of years and it's all changed, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally.
You need to be watching it all the time.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But that's coming back to us, isn't it? We've got the long view. We've got the 125 years of history. And
Another change, thinking about from the freight side, is the former EMUs, electric multiple units, reused from passengers, or withdrawn from passenger service, and then becoming carrying palletized or trolleyed goods, so then they can operate into the heart of mainline termini. That's in a way sort of coming full circle from goods coming and then being moved in smaller electrical vehicles in our urban centres. So instead of having big trucks coming into urban centres, they'll be moved either in small electric vans or electric bicycles. That's kind of almost going back to either the horse and cart or the Scammer Lion horse or whatever, taking little loads.
Yes.
To,
little three wheelers.
Yeah. It's funny how it's come full circle.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we'll ever see as much freight as we've had before there.
No.
I can't see that happening. Although we've got a lot of boxes.
Well, it's changed. It's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Intermodal.
Yeah.
And aggregates.
Yeah, we're seeing more intermodal terminals opened up, aren't we, on greenfield sites? Things like that.
But seeing the logs or the timber on the Cambrian line that we've just got in our latest issue.
Yeah.
I mean, fantastic to see hear about that.
And there's a big water contract about to start in just north of Perth.
Right.
That's going by rail, so the distribution of that.
Yeah.
So, there's a number of positives coming out of this.
Yeah.
But we haven't just reported on the news, have we? We've also
made
the news.
We have made the news.
Going way back, wasn't it one of our readers that named the Cornish Riviera Express way back?
Yes,
readers' competition. Started, I suppose that's how it all started, really. Yeah, it's always been nice to make the news. we sponsored a Pendolino with Virgin Trains that actually broke the record for running from Glasgow to Euston. We were all aboard, weren't we?
We were.
Along with some lucky readers who'd won a pole. And it was pretty nerve-wracking at one stage because some stupid lorry driver had struck a bridge somewhere near Warrington. And it was touch and go whether we were going to be allowed to go over the bridge, but we were, and we got into Euston in record time.
3 hours, 55 minutes, 27 seconds.
Well done, Chris. Yeah, I was hoping somebody would have shipped him on that.
The southbound run, yes. And then last year,
you tried to set the fastest northbound run
and missed out
just
by
unlucky.
About 20 seconds.
20 seconds, yeah. That's so cruel, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think there was some debate at the time that the restrictions at Carstairs were primarily responsible. And I think at the moment we're about to go through a complete reorganisation of the track at Carstairs.
Yeah.
So
you have another go for.
I believe
there will be one at some point.
You have to do one on the East Coast as well.
Wow.
Because we were talking earlier about perks. I mean, some of the perks that we've had is the three of us probably you as well, Paul. It'd be amazing. I mean, probably the one that sticks mostly in my mind is just before the Channel Tunnel Rail Link opened, the week before the signalling had been switched on, they said they were going to try and break the British speed record. And they got a Eurostar specially tuned up, and to keep the load down, they only invited a few people, so there's just journalists really and some VIPs. And I was one of the lucky ones invited. And we went on this this train from, I think it ran from Ashford to Waterloo. And it had, in the coach we were in, there was a TV screen in the corner at one end. And they had a great big digital readout of the speed. And we knew that after this week, they would be 186 miles an hour maximum. And after that, the signalling wouldn't allow you to go any faster. So we got up to 186, and then it was a case of keeping your fingers crossed. And it was so exciting to watch and look out the window and see everything flying by.
Yeah.
And we were watching, and it went 190, and then it started creeping up really slow. It got 200 miles an hour, and everybody went, yes! And then it went 201, 201.2, 201.3, wow. And eventually it got up to 208. Didn't it? 208.4 was it? And then it started slowing down. And the most amazing thing that I remember was the noise, because I expected to hear the conventional train noise, like clink, 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 clink. Oh, the welding rail, I know, but you know what I mean? And, and the whoosh of the sound outside, because it wasn't. It was more like a long, loud, droning noise that just got built up and got louder and louder and louder. And it was the electric motors straining.
Yeah.
And it was sort of really strange because it was insulated from the outside sound. And it was just... and it was like that. And it got louder and louder. It built into this crescendo of that noise. And it was so untrain-like. But I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I feel so privileged, to have run at over 200, it's more than Formula One speed, isn't it? On land in this country. And I suppose you won't do it again until they open HS2. They might try and break that record, but I probably won't be around for that. The way that's going, I won't be around. But that was a real privilege. And I was on the East Coast one that did 154 miles an hour, the new photograph.
That was another
exciting time, especially for me, because we went through Grantham, you see.
But you also had another privilege, didn't you, that you appeared on Top Gear.
Do you know, that's the thing most people remember now, members of the public.
Yeah.
Mm.
You were on Top Gear, weren't you?
You were in the posh seats, weren't you?
That was really weird. Yeah, that was on the Great Central when they had the
caravans.
They had literally a caravans train, a caravans around. And it was hauled by a converted car, wasn't it, with rail wheels.
Yes.
And what's his name? Was driving it, wasn't he, the guy who runs it?
Clarkson.
Jeremy Clarkson, He was driving. And poor old Murray Brown of Rail.
Yeah,
he was in the car with him at the front. But I got one of the luxury seats in one of the caravans where there was like waiter service.
coming through.
I was with the NRM head, and we were sitting, and this chap came through and started spilling coffee while I was on purpose. It was a real Mickey take, you know. But the thing was, it was we had such fun making that, you know. And then at the end of the day, they set the whole thing on fire and burnt it, you know. And then they had a peak crash into it, didn't they?
Yeah,
and send it to smithereens, this caravan. And to this day, people still come up, like, members of other families I meet in social circles.
You were on Top Gear,
weren't you? All those other things I've done, that's all they've done. It shows the power of TV.
Yeah.
But you were instrumental in the saving of Pendennis Castle.
Oh yes, that was I'm very pleased that we were able to do that. Mm. Yeah, and that was a lucky stroke, because my Australian contributor rang me up at home one day and said that Hammersley Iron had, Rio Tinto had approached him as a facilitator to see if he could find someone to buy Pendennis Castle, because they were thinking of disposing of it.
It was marooned in Australia.
It was marooned. It couldn't run because they'd changed all the signalling for the iron ore trains, and it was no longer compatible, and it was going to cost too much money to convert it. The enthusiasts in the society, the Pilbara Railway Society, had lost interest and were drifting away. And Rio Tinto was saddled with this old British steam engine they didn't know what to do with. And Tom Winterbourne, my correspondent, said, "You were the person I thought of to ring. Can you suggest anything?" So I immediately thought of the Great Western Society in Didcot, because I knew the people there. So I rang them in confidence, and from there sprang the most amazing sort of cloak and dagger story imaginable, because we obviously had to keep it quiet, A, to stop competitor magazines finding out, and B, to stop anybody else buying it in the meantime, because a millionaire could have stepped in and taken it to America or anything. So I had to sort of get them to agree to A, keep quiet about it, and B, when it did break that we could break the story, it had to be our exclusive. Mm. And it lasted nearly a year. And I was keeping fingers crossed all the time. I couldn't write a thing. Oh, I had written something to say it might be for sale, hadn't I?
Mm.
And we put that on the front cover. But then from there, it had to be real, sort of keep quiet. And I think Robin Jones started finding out about it, didn't he? And I was paranoid that he was going to put something in Heritage before I could get it into us. So,
Heritage Railway wasn't our sister title.
No, it was separate.
And I thought, oh, Bobby's bound to get it. So I rang Richard Cratchit at Didcot. I said, "I think we're going to have to run with this when you bought it." He said, "We haven't bought it yet." He said, "We're still in sort of like tenterhooks, you know." He said, "I said, how far away are you? You know, can you speed it up a bit? I'm going to press on such and such a date." Yeah. And he said, "I'll see what I can do, you know, because I know we promised you that you can have it, you know." I was on tenterhooks. I thought, what if Robin comes out before I do? And so eventually, I rang him again. He said, we've done it, we've actually bought it. I went, yes! And it was such a sense of relief, you know? And so we ran the story, didn't we, as an exclusive. And Robin came out that same week with the same story, didn't he? About 2 or 3 days after. And I thought, yes, we've beaten him, you know? But that was it. So that was a case of making the news, as well as reporting on it. Yeah, definitely.
Now Pendennis is
back in steam.
Last month. Yeah, fantastic. So I'm so pleased. That's all worked out.
Back in the country.
That's right.
Back in action.
The magazine also had a responsibility for Flying Scotsman, didn't it?
We helped to save that, didn't we?
Yes.
We ran a reader's appeal.
Yes, Save Our Scotsman,
SOS. Yeah.
Was that before the museum bought it, or was that...
Before.
At the time, it was uncertain what was going to happen to it. There was a lot of talk, again, about it going abroad, particularly America.
Mm.
And obviously that would have been...
Where it had been.
Unthinkable, yeah.
Yeah.
So was this... Which point was this then? Who got it for sale?
It was...
I think
it was part of the estate of Tony Marchington.
Right, yeah.
Or...
Pete Waterman and Tony, they owned it jointly.
Pete Bill owned it jointly. They sold it to Tony.
That's right. Oh, Bill told me a great story about that. He said he was sitting in his living room, and Tony said, "How much do you want for it?" And Bill said, Well, I think I can't remember, was it? 150,000 or something, 200,000, whatever it was. It was in the way really expensive price, right? And he gave a price, and Tony went, well, and he was saying aloud, thinking, like, there's like hundreds of thousands plus the taxi fare to get here tonight. Yeah, okay, I'll buy it.
I think I'd just like to say a bit about where we are now at Morton's.
Yeah.
I think in 2010, when the magazine was bought from IPC by Morton's, there was a little bit of trepidation, wasn't there, about moving to the middle of Lincolnshire from central London.
Yeah.
I think that would be fair to say. But I think to counter that, the management of Morton's at the time and even now have been utterly fantastic.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, it was like very much an attitude. And I remember Dan Savage saying to this to Nick and I on the first day we arrived at Horncastle. He said, look, you guys are the experts. You know your readers. You know your markets. You can get on with it. I won't be breathing over your shoulder. The door's always open if there's a problem.
Mm.
And I think, you know, when I was editor, I felt that was the case even then, that you know, there was certainly no interference from the back. So,
it's turned out to be a really good home for the magazine.
It's been a brilliant home.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
despite being about as far away from a railway as...
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? I mean, the very first Morton this year, I did a two-page spread on Horncastle's railways.
Yeah, that's
right. It's a case of digging deep.
Yeah.
No, that was good. And Morton's, I also ought to add to what Chris has just said, that they improved the production values of the magazine because it was getting a bit thin paper at IPC towards the end. And they as Chris has just said, they were very hands-on. And I understand that one of the conditions of the sale was that Chris and I went with it, you know. So we kind of felt that it was a good home.
Mm.
And who knows what would have happened if we'd stayed in London, because a little bit later on they all moved out to Farnborough.
Yes.
And that would have been very hard for us to commute to, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But what about, obviously we've spanned various things, our own anecdotes for 125 years, although some of us aren't quite that old, but what do you foresee over the next 125 years?
Yeah, as we mentioned before, there's so much changing every day, bit by bit. All builds up. There's so much to look forward to, though. Not least, perhaps HS1, which will make a massive difference to HS2.
HS2 even, yeah.
HS2, which will make a massive difference to
what about
our rail network.
Oh yes, well, our railways now. Yeah. What about automation, though? Or driverless trains and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Do you see that as a?
We invite the readers to
sit down. I can't see that on the near future. No.
No.
No. Can you?
I can. Because if you think that technology is normally developed for road applications first, especially on the truck side, the rules of the highway code have been adapted recently for, we've got driverless automated vehicle automation. I think it's going to be reality that it's there on the horizon. It's closer than it's ever been.
Mm.
And if you think there is some precedence there with a railway would be easier to keep control of than a public road.
Mm.
You've got fewer variables. You haven't got a pedestrian's not so likely to step off a pavement on a driverless road. On a railway, it's going to be fenced.
Mm.
And you still get trespass. But
yeah, we've got used to it on the Docklands railway, anyway. But on a 150-mile-an-hour mainline train.
I suppose if you think we've got it's there on the horizon, having electric trucks, lorries, and driverless HGVs.
But what about things like, you know, it's talked about often, but it never actually gets put into practice, is wider electrification.
True, yeah.
Which is really, if we're going to go greener in this country, is what we need.
True.
You know, we've got the crazy situation of Voyager trains working from Glasgow through Edinburgh all the way down the East Coast main line under the wires and then down to Plymouth and Penzance, you know.
I think there's a feeling now that we could almost leapfrog electrification to other fuels that don't need wires. Batteries or hydrogen or...
True.
What you think bi-mode might actually be a better idea than...
I'm not saying that's my opinion. I'm just saying that people who are making these decisions are perhaps thinking, why do we install expensive electrification when there might be something else, such as high-powered batteries?
You're right there, because if we take an example of the Stadler Class 755s, the engine unit in those is designed to actually have something like batteries or even a fuel cell.
Why you take that now?
Yes, yeah, it was designed specifically with that in mind, looking ahead to the future. But the difficulty is obviously in the modification of existing trains to encompass that new technology.
But you've got this technology in buses that the GPS will tell the bus to shut down its power unit or to go on to electric mode. Well, geofencing, and the bus will know where it is on the globe and where on the map, where to power up, where to run quietly, if you like. Well, railways could possibly do that, couldn't they?
There are buses that actually run on batteries, and they pull into a charging station with the charging pantograph that goes up.
What I was thinking was whether you could possibly be where a train is electric for where there's catenary or whatever there, and then where it's challenging to put in catenary, say in a tunnel, for example, or under a bridge, because of you could then have it could be intelligent enough or smart enough to know that I'm going to have to run on battery for that section or over that viaduct or whatever. So then that might cut the cost of installation.
Steel wheel on steel rail, can we see that still being around in 100 years' time?
I can't see anything better than that, really, at the moment.
You don't think there'll be things flying through the air, like personal, you get your personal space and you fly in a little pod or something?
Yeah,
I think that's as far away now as it was 100 years ago.
What about these awful guided busways and things? Concrete railways.
I think they've fallen out of favour, haven't they?
It's more like Luton now, isn't it, as well as Cambridge.
Cambridge, Luton, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they've proved that successful, have they? So hopefully we've seen the last of those.
Yeah.
Because didn't Leeds abandon their plans? Or are they sort of lurking?
No, they kind of got them, but now. Now Leeds is hopefully getting a metro again.
Yeah, the Transport Works Act application failed, didn't it? Because to open a guided busway, it requires the same legal process as it does, and the same with putting a trolley bus network in. The same, you have to go through the same legal process, or similar legal process, Transport and Works Act order, as you would if you're putting a railway in.
Okay. Well, what about this development at Warwick University, the very light railway vehicle?
Yeah.
Where obviously you don't have to dig down quite so deep and disturb the utilities in quite the way that traditional tram networks have had to do.
Well, that's really exciting for city
centre use. Yeah,
absolutely.
And obviously making city centres obviously giving cleaner air. Yeah,
definitely.
Right. Nottingham and Sheffield have been great success stories, haven't they? And Manchester.
Manchester especially.
Yeah. I think Leeds does need one.
It does. It's one of the biggest cities not to have.
Yeah. Leeds and Bristol, yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, all for it. Great. Yeah.
What a journey the Railway Magazine's been on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic.
No, I just wish we didn't age and then we could carry on doing it. Well, good luck to Morton's, and I hope it stays. And you, Paul.
Thank you.
You've been doing a brilliant job and keeping it going. Gareth, you too. Yeah. And I just hope long may it continue.
Thank you. Yeah. We aim to live up to the standards that you've all set.
Yeah. Very high bar.
No limboing then.
As you know, it's nice for us to sit here and to see two people who are going to take it forward.
Yeah,
who were young and enthusiastic, just like we used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're lucky.
So best of luck to both of you. Yeah.
Thank you. We're also lucky to be able to be friends with you guys as well. We can ask and pick your brains. And
anytime.
While we're still here, just pick up the phone. We don't.
Yeah.
Know, so it's nice to be remembered.
Great. Excellent. Yeah.
Thank you. Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.